I'm Steve from Maryland, whose prolific convention attending, I mean, charity work in the East End, keeps me busy on the last Sunday of every month.
And I'm Al from New Zealand, up early to record this episode and looking forward to breakfast when I will toast the bread of Dracula.
We are Hammerama, the podcast which gathers every month to revive the dark glories of Hammer Horror through the unholy ritual of podcasting.
Our theme music is from the wonderful House of the Gorgon by the equally wonderful Reba Clark, and our film this month is 1970's Taste the Blood of Dracula.
Feel the cold grip of his presence. Sense the clammy excitement of his evil. Taste the sharp fear that he alone can bring.
Dracula's blood.
This way, gentlemen.
We know the way.
These men thought they had tasted all that life had to offer.
Ready when you are, gentlemen.
Would you be willing to sell your souls to the devil?
If one thought that one's experience might be extended.
It would be extended to infinity.
There's something there.
Dracula is back. To choose his human victims.
Alice.
Who are you? How do you know my name?
Dracula is back to select his companions in darkness, who must die that he may live. If you shock easily, stay away.
She's neither dead nor alive.
Lucy! 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 Back to listen to me! The marks on her neck! She's a vampire!
Prepare yourself. Every nerve, every muscle.
No.
Prepare yourself for the greatest shock of all.
The Count finally makes it to Victorian London, but seems to have made the first-time tourist error of not researching what to see and do first. A satanic ritual results in Ralph Bates being beaten to death by the British Defense Minister from James Bond, plasticine inventor Wallace, and Captain Kronos's... friend Dr. Marcus. In other words, three brothel-frequenting gentlemen played by Jeffrey Keane, Peter Salas, and John Carson. Fleeing the scene, they missed the resurrection of Dracula. Despite being in the title, the Count now finds himself standing around for most of the film, using the young cast to enact revenge for the murder of someone he's never met and whose demise he wouldn't even exist without. Instead of getting a much-needed haircut, he lurks about numbering the deaths of his victims, like another famous count from Sesame Street.
I am the Count, because I love to count things.
Dracula eventually resorts to throwing bits of masonry around in frustration until being attacked by a church. The Count's trip advisor rating for the first trip to London is pretty bad, but to be fair, he didn't really make the effort to get out and about. But apparently, he has more fun during his next couple of visits.
He sure does. Right, Steve. Brilliant. Thank you. I'm going to give my first thoughts.
Go for it, Al.
So although our synopsis might suggest otherwise, I actually have a great deal of affection for this film. because back in 1983, it was the first time I ever gathered a group of friends together at my home to collectively watch one of Television New Zealand's Sunday horrors. And this then became a weekly tradition that we kept up for many years. Now, a very intelligent and highly literate friend, Mark, are you listening? Quite rightly pointed out all the plot problems during this, his first Hammer film. But, you know, that was all part of the fun, and we lapped up the blood of Dracula with relish. The ending confused us a little, and I think we somehow imagined that breaking the stained glass window maybe let in some holiness from an adjoining sanctified part of the church, and that was what did the count in. Other theories included him tripping on his cloak, or the actor panicking and passing out on learning about the tiny fee he was being paid. Any of those theories could work.
A pittance!
A pittance! That's it, I'm leaving. But once again, this film isn't really about Dracula. And that is its strength, not its weakness. Victorian hypocrisy, emerging youth culture, and the introduction of Satanism into Hammer's Dracula, although it was always there if you read Stoker's novel carefully, this film really strikes me as a study of the fresh younger generation supplanting the corrupt and stagnant previous one. Young Courtly humiliates and dominates the three fathers, and their own children actually kill them. Yes, the apparent age of Dracula himself maybe ruins this theory, but remember, his part was originally supposed to be occupied by the more youthful Lord Courtly. Personally, I think this might be one of the best and definitely biggest casts of any of the Hammer Dracula films. Jeffrey Keane, Peter Sallis, Linda Hayden, Isla Blair, Michael Ripper, Roy Kinnear, Madeline Smith, Ralph Bates, and Sir Chris, of course. All brilliantly defined and performed characters. What about you, Steve?
Well, Al, it's been an ongoing theme of a good portion of the movies in Hammerama. This was my first time seeing. So, taste the blood of Dracula. So I'm watching it, and I've heard some things about it prior. So I knew that originally, as you've already mentioned, it was supposed to be Ralph Bates through it all. But I think the American company, whoever was financing it, said, no, we want Christopher Lee. And so they wrote him in, and Ralph Bates' character. Part of me wonders, really wants to read the script the way it would have been to see how that all flowed and how it all would have played out, so to speak. It's an interesting movie, and we said in our synopsis, there is some supernatural elements. Is Dracula really a demon who comes up in a vampiric form? And because he had his minion in Lord Courtly, that's why he knew what had happened prior, because he was upset that he got killed. So it could be that his presence was there, even though he was not physically present at the time. So that could be one thing that's going on. And it's interesting how he had the children, as you said, off the elders. And if you think about it, at the time this came out, early 70s, and what was going on in the times and the culture and everything, and of course that was the youth movement, at least in the United States. I don't know if it was the same in England or to as much.
It was.
And so this would be a timely film in that aspect. And you definitely had some characters you wanted to see get offed. Jeffrey Keane, you wanted him to suffer a comeuppance, because he was a jerk of total utmost proportions, and how he treated his wife and daughter, and then the shenanigans that he would do on the last Sunday of the month when he's doing his charity work.
Yes, yes.
The ending, I was pondering how this ending came about. That was literally, I think most people, they're watching this film the first time, are wondering what just happened and how did it end this way. And my initial take is God struck him down in a way, because the church suddenly is restored in Dracula's mind. You hear the singing, you hear the sermon. It was divine intervention that did in the count. I'm still processing it today. It's been a few days since I've seen it. I think the plot's a little convoluted. I'm being long about my first impression here. I'm sorry.
That's not like you at all, Steve. As usual, that's good quality stuff. As to what actually finishes Dracula off, I think divine intervention is a perfect way to put it. My impression was that Paul re-sanctified the church. He lays out the altar with the proper candles, with the proper finery, and it's like he's rebooting an operating system. He restarts it, and it actually takes a while to kind of boot up. Then just at the moment where it was needed, the church becomes re-sanctified in Dracula's eyes. In some ways, I think it's good that there's mystery and room for debate here. Part of me kind of likes that, but then I also know that perhaps if it was edited a little more carefully, then there would be less of a question mark hanging over it. You're absolutely right about Jeffrey Keen. Many of us would have loved to have seen him suffer longer. It's just one of many, many incredible performances where you completely believe that these are real people. And I guess, as I said in my first thoughts, that's what I really love about this film. I believe Christopher Lee himself said that although he was initially typically grumpy about being guilted, and when he saw who else was in the film, he actually started to feel an awful lot better about it.
But I want to also give credit to Linda Hayden. When she turns evil, but is possession of Dracula.
Yes.
She is gleeful about what she does to her father, which I guess all that repressed hatred that she had for him, you know? She knows how to handle a shovel.
She certainly does. And that look of glee again when she picks up the stake to help finish off the second father. Although she's not acting under her own control, she's really loving being bad. The straps have slipped off her shoulders and she's just owning it. But before we get too specific, Steve, did you want to pick a favorite scene, perhaps? Or scenes, even.
This one's an interesting one to try to come up with a favorite scene. But I'm going to go with Lord Courtly's arrival at the brothel. Mm. And because this is how we're introduced to Ralph Bates's
character. Yeah.
And then one guy is trying to stop him, you know, going and looking in all the rooms. And it's interesting because you see all the women's reactions to him. Mm-hmm. The longing, the wanting, we need this man. And which... you know, a lot of Dracula mythology has that where women just want him. It's that sexual desire that he is the forbidden fruit that they all want to have. And I think that's a nice way to say it because he's not really saying anything. Mm-hmm. He's just going through and just doing it, looking at door to door, which they did a lot of doors. and he acts like he owns the place and basically, and he has no money, but he just has the charisma and that devil may care attitude. Mm. Again, thinking of deviltry and demonicness. When he finally meets the gentleman, mm-hmm. evil trio, but not as evil as some, and how he just takes command of the room and does that and tempts them, mm-hmm. goes through. So I think that opening scene, the way it was filmed and acted, it was just, there's a change. Yeah. And it's just like, boom. And these older gentlemen can sense that change. Like, we're looking for new desires, new ways to fulfill our lust for not the norm, and that this man, this entity, could fulfill those desires, and how he just has to very slightly tempt him to come with him. It's just, they were so close to that side anyway, that it was just, come with me. And I think of the Jungle Book with Ka telling Mowgli, come with me, you know, it's like, come, and just swaying them over. There's a reference you would never expect in a Hammerama.
So I was just about to say, I really didn't see that one coming.
How about you, Al?
Well, Steve, completely agree with yours. It was a great scene. My scene, once again, as is typical with you and I, is a quiet scene. In fact, there isn't even any dialogue, but the direction and performances tells us volumes about the characters. Now, it's the scene where the coach carrying the three gentlemen stops outside the brothel and they emerge, and they are quickly mobbed by the young street urchins begging for money. Now, Hargood, Jeffrey Keen, is the first out, of course, and he barges through them with complete disdain, looking straight ahead as if they don't even exist. Paxton, Peter Salas, is next, and he's typically timid, and he even seems to be afraid of either being hurt, contaminated, or even recognized. And he follows in Hargood's wake, as usual. Last is Secker, John Carson. And he is as relaxed as Paxton was tense. He's smiling, and he even pauses to flip a coin into the air for the children. And when he watches them scramble after it, he's gently amused, and there doesn't seem to be any cruelty involved there. So the dynamic between the three men is really clear. Hargood is the self-appointed leader, barely tolerating the others, but presumably needing their financial contribution. Paxton is nervous, cowardly, and he's probably the whipping boy of the three, maybe even coerced into joining the group. Hargood's contempt of him is reflected back at Paxton's son, Paul, because probably the thought of becoming related to Paxton actually fills him with disgust, so he takes it out on his son. Now, Secker, once again, is a different story, and he's probably the most independent, principled, and definitely likable of the three. He has a good relationship with his son, and he is knowledgeable enough to be familiar with Dracula and vampire lore. He's almost the nearest thing we have to a Van Helsing in this film. He even treats Felix with respect. And, you know, he's probably along for the ride. He's along with the other two out of genuine curiosity and a sense of adventure. He doesn't appear to have a wife that he needs to lie to or deceive. And, yeah, he certainly seems to enjoy himself the most at the brothel.
I agree with you. The three men figured they were all well-to-do, church-going people, pillars of the community, you know, where everybody'd be like, oh, we want to be more, you want to be like those men, you know, just godly and righteous. Little do they know. But that brothel scene was very telling and interesting about how it was almost like the first one being very Scrooge and the other one being like the later version of Scrooge, more of giving than the other two.
Yes.
And so it had that Father Christmas type feel going with it. It was an interesting thing with the dynamic between that group, because I think Secker was like a second leader, almost like he was the one. If he would have been a leader, a lot of things would have probably happened better for the group.
I think Hargood obviously imagined himself to be the leader. But the thing about Secker is that John Carson is an extremely likable actor. It's hard to dislike him, so that helps. Because the Count has finally made it to Victorian London, it seems timely to play this excerpt from my chat with journalist and reviewer Kylie Klein-Nixon. I spoke to Kylie specifically for our Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde episode, but she had such fascinating things to say about the Victorian era, the changing role of women, and why Hammer horror works so well in this period in general, that I saved it for an ideal time, such as now. So, here's the erudite and learned Kylie Klein-Nixon on Hammer in Victorian Britain.
Obviously, for Hammer films, I think that Victorian period was sort of, it was one of real social upheaval, as you know, like it's the end of that agrarian age and the beginning of the industrial age, and people sort of flooding into the cities where conditions were just absolutely dreadful. You know, there's poverty and overcrowding and crime and smog and all those wonderfully creepy, awful things. There's massive cholera outbreaks in London in 32 and 66. There's, you know, where there's sort of talking about dead people piling up in the streets and the slums and stuff. And at the same time, there's sort of other real life horrors unfolding in London. And, you know, you've got Jack the Ripper and Burke and Hare up in Edinburgh, and also sort of things like literal cities of the dead being built outside the main city, you know, out in Highgate, Nunhead in London and Pere Lachaise in Paris. So English speaking culture kind of became obsessed with death at that time. This is the birth of spiritualism started then. You know, you've got the Fox sisters in New York talking to the dead, that kind of stuff. And the result, I think, is that sort of ominous, overbearing, emotional writing that you get of people like Edgar Allan Poe and Wilkie Collins and Stoker and Sheridan and Lefanu and Henry James. And, you know, the ghost story really comes into its own then. You know, even the greatest writer of that period, Dickens, his most famous book is a ghost story. I think at the same time, back in, you know, in the 60s, it's not quite as big a period of social upheaval, but there is that sort of sense that you're losing something of the past and that the change is really radical. That sense of we can't go back because we've ruined something, I think. And so I'm not surprised that Hammer sort of started looking back to Victorian stories. You know, in the 60s and 70s, there was this big sort of return to Victoriana and that Victorian look in those Victorian stories. And I kind of see it as a sort of knee jerk across the whole of pop culture, from fashion to film, against psychedelia and against hippie culture. And nowhere was that sort of more evident than in Hammer Horrors, where you kind of get this faux conservative vibe sort of coming out. And really, it was just a sort of psychosexual freak out over free love. The whole way of life was just being radically changed. And one of the main things that was changing was the role of women in the society. It was a huge change. They, you know, the pill and the women's movement, women going into the workplace. I mean, poor women had always worked, obviously. And poor women, women of colour, they'd always had to work. But now it was everybody. Everybody, all the women wanted to go have their own pin money. They didn't need men anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, I think, also Hammer really taps into that. And that's another reason why so many of their female characters go back to this repressed Victorian thing. You've got a different kind of woman in that period. There's more of that sort of gasping and shrieking and fainting. Or you're playing up the sexual liberation side of things.
The ladies, the young ladies, the glee they take with Alice Hargood holding that stake there and just looking back like, oh, isn't this just the greatest thing? And I don't believe, and I've read a couple things afterwards where some people say that she's a vampire too. I never believed that she was ever a vampire because she was shown in daylight. I think she was a minion or whatever, however he possessed her, because you also don't see any bite marks on
exactly.
her neck.
I think it's interesting. This film almost implies that it's a two-part process to actually either put someone in his thrall or convert them to vampirism. Hammer changed its lore from film to film, but like you, Steve, I don't believe that Alice ever was vampirized, but she was certainly very much within his thrall. And I think, in fact, Dracula needed someone who could move around in the daylight and do things that he wasn't able to. Otherwise, there wouldn't really be much point.
And I also believe this is one of the first times, I think, where it implies there's two different types of bites from Dracula.
Exactly.
There's the bite to turn, and there's the bite to end.
Yes.
Because that's what he did with the second vampire. You know, he bites her, and then her old expression, she's like wanting it, and then she realizes, oh no, this is the bad bite. I guess he drains her, and she's dead. That was weird. I never knew a vampire could drain another vampire that way and kill him. It was, which I know with vampire lore happened. I bought it, but it was just new to me.
I think something very similar happens with Xena in the previous film, where Dracula gives her the bad bite, as you called it, and finishes her off. That might be the rare case of a consistency here.
There are some layers here that are interesting unpacked. Mm.
I found it interesting enough to want to go back to my connection section for the first time in a long time. And I'll do that now, if that's okay with you.
Oh, no, I'm interested to see, or actually hear, how you connect the dots between this and the other ones with Alistair's connections.
Well, actually, Steve, this is probably the easiest connections that I've ever done, because I'm going to talk about the Dracula cycle, Hammer's Dracula cycle so far. And it's easy because it was very clearly designed to connect. So Taste of Blood of Dracula forms the final link in an unbroken chain of connected chapters. As I say, this is a really good opportunity for me to review just how well these films have related to each other. Now, Horror of Dracula famously ends with the Count disintegrating into dust in 1885, coming off second best in A Stoush with the Kush. This ending is reprised at the beginning of Brides of Dracula, which is set approximately 5 years later. Another 5 years passes before Clove uses the blood of the recently slain Alan Kent to revive the Count in 1895 in Dracula, Prince of Darkness. This time Dracula meets his demise under the icebound moat of his own castle. Now, and Dracula has risen from the grave. He rises not from a grave, but from an icy stream, a decade after, and he imbibes the blood of an injured priest. And the Count would have got away with it if it hadn't been for those pesky kids, Paul and Maria. And he eventually finds himself impaled on a giant cross at the foot of his castle. Now, although we don't realize this until the following film, this one that we're discussing, Taste the Blood of Dracula, his agonized cries are heard by stranded snow globe merchant Weller. Weller collects the Count's powdered remains and personal effects, transporting them back to London. Now, a year or so later, he sells them to Hargood, Secker and Paxton for use in Lord Courtly's satanic ritual. At the climax of the events which follow, the Count finds himself destroyed by unexpected church attendance, crumbling to dust on a re-sanctified altar. So, spanning 26 years of the late Victorian and early Edwardian era, these five superb films, the first half of Hammer's Dracula cycle, bat-tailed perfectly. And they would have continued to do so if it weren't for the continuity-busting next film, Scars of Dracula. But more on that one another time.
Just like connecting the dots. It was just simple as 1, 2, 3.
Connecting the bats.
Oh. Yes, connecting the bats. Well, I was just trying to think because, you know, this episode was brought to you by the Count and the number 3.
1, 2, 3.
I just wanted to mention as well, I almost never get to do this. I don't often get to claim that I've met a star of these films. It's almost always you, Steve, because you have the opportunities with the huge conventions and everything. Happens very rarely for me, so I'm not going to miss the opportunity to mention that I was lucky enough to meet Felix. Scottish actor Russell Hunter, who plays Felix, I met him at a Doctor Who convention in 1990. Now, he was there because he also played Sandminer Commander Uvanov in 1977 in The Robots of Death. His character is silly enough to try and manhandle Leela. Felix is a wonderfully fruity character in Taste the Blood of Dracula, and Hunter plays him to the absolute hilt. But sadly, back in 1990, I was young and ignorant and didn't ask him about it. But I can claim to have seen him and got his autograph. So there we go.
To me, it was just nice to be able to meet him, shake their hand, or you still got to meet your idols. As you know, that you grew up watching when we were wee lads.
But just thinking back to that convention, that was the same one, I've mentioned this before, that Julian Glover was present at. And Julian Glover is famously married to Isla Blair, Lucy. So there's another connection with this film. So, Steve, are we at final thoughts?
I guess we are. Hmm. Do you want me to go first or do you want to go first?
You go first because I've been talking for ages.
This one's an interesting for me to look at with the movies I've seen in Dracula, only judging the ones we've seen for this podcast. Mm-hmm. I'd have to put it at the bottom of the group that I've seen so far. And I think it's because I wanted more. More? Yes, yes. I wanted more Lee. You know, more there. And I'm not blaming Christopher Lee. The script is written the way it's written. Mm. And as you said, he's standing around. Because, I mean, it is called Taste the Blood of Dracula. Mm-hmm. So you want some Dracula in a movie that has Dracula in the title. Mm. The movie has a lot of good things with it. But there are things that are total. Secker gets shot, falls outside the ruined church, not far, and passes out. Doesn't wake up to the following morning. Yet Dracula does nothing to him.
Mm.
Nor any of his people. He's right there. Mm-hmm. Number 3 is just outside the door.
The third.
You do it so much better than I would. And, you know, and you could have sent Lucy off to go get his son so she could, you know, did her little charms like she did, and boom, you know, he's gone. But I understand we need him to survive longer. And then he stumbles back. He starts to write his notes. And, of course, he passes out again because I don't need no stinking doctor. You know, it's just a flesh wound. Or as Jesse Ventura said in The Predator, I ain't got time to bleed. Going for those other movie references today.
Of course, of course. While you're doing that, Steve, can I just quickly make a movie reference at this point?
Please, please.
when Sekka becomes the Third, did you get a Force Awakens vibe? Think of it. He's gently touching his son's face after a surprise stabbing. And then, like Han Solo, he tumbles out of the movie.
That is true. Mm. Now, that would mean that J.J. Abrams yep. was influenced by it. I doubt Harrison Ford saw it. And, you know. So it's a hard movie for me to rate because there's things I thought there were it was going to go one way and went another way, mm-hmm. and it didn't always make logical sense. The count, maybe it's because the way he was brought back or whatever, but his hand-eye coordination with throwing things was terrible. And he could have just went down there and just did the old fisticuffs mm-hmm. routine and did them in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not even looking. It's not like they're even dodging the throws. Because Paul's looking the wrong way. He's looking at Alice. Alice is looking at Paul. Nobody's looking at the stuff that the Count's doing. It was...
Having said that, though, Steve, although it doesn't look like he has a hope of hitting them, you think of health and safety. I doubt they'd have been able to get away with that scene today, because as far as I can see, that stuff is landing quite close to the actual actors as they're scurrying around. So although they're probably not in any real danger, it wouldn't pass the health and safety test these days.
Well, I guess you can almost say it had a spaghetti western type feel with safety production.
Yeah, exactly.
But overall, I enjoyed the movie mm-hmm. in a weird, perverse way. But I could see where some people could enjoy it more than me. Mm. I was talking to my son Ben after watching, and I said, "This is the weakest one that I've seen so far." Mm-hmm. He's like, "Should I see it?" I said, "Well, we own it." I said, "You might as well watch it. You know, judge your own. You know, make your own opinion mm-hmm. because you never know." He's younger.
Yeah,
he's somebody in the 20s, and this message of this movie is youth overcoming age.
Absolutely.
Maybe it's because I'm seeing it and I'm at the age mm-hmm. all the fathers are at, even though you and I both look a lot better than those guys. You know, even though we're probably older than those actors, it's just amazing how times change.
Listeners, you'll just have to take Steve's word for that.
For those of you that are, you know, have never seen it before, I'd definitely say you have to see it, because if you're a Hammer fan and it's Dracula, you want to be a completist. You don't want to miss one of the middle mm-hmm. ones. And there is that loose continuity where everything is one's leading into another, yeah. and so on. And I'm hoping that people seek this out, enjoy it, and really relish it for what it is.
I get the impression, Steve, that you're kind of in two minds. And I have to say, I was the same way. I am the same way. But I think I found a way to kind of rationalize it in my own mind.
Drugs?
Yes. Drugs. Caffeine. Charity work in the East End. Yeah, just... It has to be noted that it's 1970 when this film comes out, and the nudity and violence has clearly been ramped up. So the blood might be fluorescent, but there's plenty of it splashed around, and there are brief topless shots in the brothel for the first time, I think, in a Hammer Dracula. But it's a brothel, so this might be expected. We have Satanism and even implied incest. I'm loath to say it, but the two best known characters in this film are also probably the most disappointing for me, and they both suffer from bad hair days. Now, I love Ralph Bates, but somehow, I'm sorry, but somehow his surprisingly high-pitched voice and anachronistic haircut just don't work for Courtly. The potential's there, but I don't think he quite carries it off. Now, it's a far inferior film, but his Baron Frankenstein, for example, in appearance and portrayal, I think would have fitted this part much better. And Christopher Lee himself really is reduced to just a cipher, stepping out of the shadows to keep tally of the death toll. And the worst Dracula wig he's ever had to wear. It's too long, and the widow's peak is just about halfway down his forehead, and it's so bad it actually makes him look like his own stunt double in some of the scenes. Now, that's a tiny thing, but once you notice it, you can't unsee it, and it really annoys me. But he does look splendidly feral when he finishes off Lucy with that bad bite, as we were talking about. Strangely enough, Lucy is minus her fangs in that scene, but... Anyway.
Maybe it's because of the bad bite.
The overbite.
I was going to say, when you're talking about him coming out for his scenes, kind of to Christopher Lee, it's almost like he's reduced to the role of town crier.
Yeah.
Thirst.
Yeah. The thirst. Perhaps he really only had himself to blame because, as we all know, he was stepping late into a script that had already been written without him. I'm only glad that he got so much more to do in the Dracula films, which will follow and which we will get to. Despite all that, as I said before, I think the cast of characters and the performances in this film are absolutely top-notch. And the enjoyment that I get from this film is really all the parts that don't necessarily involve the lead character. I love the interplay between the three fathers, between the families. I even enjoy the romance with someone called Paul, which seems to me to be a lot more believable and charming than it has been in other films. So as I say, we all know that Taste was originally Dracula-less. And I have to conclude that I think it would have worked just as well without him.
I think it would have. Like I said, I'm just curious to see the script, to know what it would have been like if Ralph Bass's character would have been all the way through. I definitely agree with you. The voice, well, maybe he would have played it differently if he would have had that alteration.
Maybe.
That could have been what he was playing, that I'm going to be this way, and then I'm going to change it to maybe deepen it a little. I mean, who knows how he would have
really
played the role.
Really good point, Steve. Maybe he was doing that so that he could deliberately have a contrast for when he becomes the main vampire. Hadn't thought of that.
And there could have been a better wig or hair.
You can only hope.
But judging by that, it's what the women all wanted. So, I mean, you know, whatever it was, according to the movie, it...
It was his aftershave.
I think we have to roll the die to see what's going to be coming mm-hmm. next.
What do the numbers mean?
I'm going to ask you now, Adel, if you can go off the list. What is number one?
Number one is Dracula. Number two is Frankenstein. Number three is The Mummy. Number four is science fiction. Number five is prehistoric. And number six is...
the experimental 70s. So let me roll the die. Two!
Oh, thank goodness. You know, something that really bothers me, Steve, is that we do a Hammer Horror podcast... and we've done, what, two Frankenstein films so far? So we really, really needed to get back to The Baron. And as this is the third film, we're going to be covering Evil of Frankenstein.
Ah, Evil. I love it.
I love it too.
I don't think I've seen it. I don't think I've seen Evil Frankenstein.
I'm not going to say too much about it, Steve, but you might find the change in style a little bit jarring, but I just have to mention probably one of the few if only times in history that the monster is played by a New Zealander. So I'm looking forward to this one.
Oh, the sacrilege.
I know. G'day. So Evil of Frankenstein, I'm really looking forward to that. And in fact, I'm not going to say too much about it at the moment, Steve, but I can think of the perfect guest. If we can get him, because he's an extremely busy man, leave that with me, and we'll see what we can do.
And Alistair, I just want to let you know, we did receive some feedback.
Did we? Oh, yes, we did.
Yes, yes, we did. And it was emailed to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com. So if you have feedback for the show, send it to the email address, and we'll share it along on the show. And this one is from Patrick, and he said, "Hi, Stephen. I really enjoyed all the Hammerama episodes, to be honest. I'm a huge fan of that era in British horror, especially Hammer and Amicus movies. My favorite Hammer films are the Dracula series." Oh, I think he's probably liking this episode. At least I hope
Perfect
he does.
Timing.
"So I've particularly enjoyed those episodes. I really like the rapport between you guys and the enthusiasm you have for the movies. Even the ones which are a little ropey." Well, that would be this one. Again, perfect timing, Patrick. You sent this email at just the right time. I feel like you guys really get the balance right when it comes to joking about some of the silly aspects of the movies while still showing appreciation and affection for them. Many thanks, Patrick."
Patrick, thank you so much. It's so good to hear from people who listen to our little podcast, and those are really, really kind words. I love the Dracula cycle as well. It's my favorite part of Hammer. And thanks so much for writing it and letting us know.
And I've been enjoying my ride so far, getting to see a lot of Hammer that I hadn't seen before. So far, I think my overall favorite series so far, I think, has been the science fiction part, the two Quatermass movies. But I also love the 70s. The 70s is right there, number two. And of course, we get this crossover because here this is part of the Dracula series, so to speak. But yet it is a 70s movie. Yes. So it's kind
of... First half, almost exactly, of the Dracula cycle has come to an end. And now, as you say, we're into the experimental 1970s. I should also mention, just while we're talking about feedback, Daphne... Thank you so much for missing Steve and I when we had to take a slightly unplanned summer break. But we really appreciate you noticing, and we also appreciate your really lovely, kind thoughts when you listened to our comeback episode, which of course was the Quatermass Experiment.
Patrick, we have news for you too, because you brought up Amicus. And I think Alistair wants to make sure that people know about something we did.
This is very, very timely. By the time this episode comes out, what I'm going to be referring to will have been released. And that is the Classic Horrors Club podcast. Our very, very good friends, Rich and Jeff, actually invited us onto one of their Halloween shows. So we had a crossover.
Hi, I'm Jeff Owens.
And I'm Richard Chamberlain. And we want you to join our club, the Classic Horrors Club.
Every month, Richard and I host the Classic Horrors Club podcast, where we talk about our favorite subject, horror movies.
Some of them are classics.
We all go a little mad sometimes.
And some definitely aren't.
What you see is real. What's done is done, and what I've done is right. It's the work of science.
But we love them all the same. We also have special theme months where we highlight the legendary stars.
And we head to the drive-ins of the past every summer for exciting double and triple features.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle.
And we even have occasional guests.
My obsession, and it is truly an obsession, I suppose, of Frankenstein, the true story, dates back to when it first aired in two parts on NBC in 1973.
So join the fun and listen to the Classic Horrors Club podcast today. Hosted by SoundCloud, we're available wherever fine podcasts are found. And for even more fun, check out the video companion on our YouTube channel.
And remember,
we sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment.
And the film that we discussed is the controversial Scream and Scream Again, which was, of course, an Amicus and AIP co-production. It's particularly timely to mention this one because one of the stars of Taste the Blood of Dracula, the wonderful Peter Sallis, also has a part in Scream and Scream Again. Now, Jeff, Rich, Steve and I discussed this wonderful film on episode 87. Of the Classic Horrors Club podcast, which many of you may already have heard. But if you haven't, I would urge you to go and listen to that one, because if you have a fraction of the fun that the four of us had actually recording it, then I think you'll really, really enjoy listening to it. So, Scream and Scream Again, the Classic Horrors Club podcast, episode 87.
And don't forget, Christopher Lee is in both for just about the same amount of screen time.
Absolutely. Yeah, isn't that amazing? I'm talking about Peter Sallis. I completely forgot Christopher Lee was in it.
I know, I'm thinking, forget about Christopher Lee. We talk about him all the time. Let's go to something else.
We certainly talk about him an awful lot in that episode. So hopefully that makes up for it.
But as always, I had a fun time talking with you. And again, listeners, we saw we had that unexpected hiatus, but the wheels on the cart came off for a little bit, but we got the cart fixed. We've used duct tape and baling wire, and it is working again.
Even if our cart gets mobbed by street urchins when it stops, we are plowing ahead. We already have the next few episodes planned, and we're really enjoying being back. All right, well, it just remains for us then to say thank you, as always, for listening, everyone. please, if you feel inclined, send in your feedback because we love hearing it. Just before we close, although Evil of Frankenstein will be our next in our regular run, next month is December, and as such, we will first of all be tackling Hammer's other Christmas movie, Cash on Demand from 1961. Steve and I are both very excited about this one and promise you a far more festive time than we had with The Lodge last Christmas. So warm up a mince pie, pour yourself a glass of your favourite Yuletide tipple, and join us next month for Cash on Demand.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.